Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Andrea Blythe, co-host of New Books and Poetry, a podcast of the New Books Network. Today, we're speaking with Ivy Johnson about her new book, Born Again, which was published by The Operating System. Ivy is a poet and performance artist living in Oakland, California. Her first book, As They Fall, is a collection of 110 note cards for aleatoric ritual and was published by Timeless Infinite Light in 2013. She is co-founder of The Third Thing, an ecstatic feminist art duo, which published their first self-titled chapbook with Portable Press at Yo-Yo Labs in 2016. Hi, Ivy. Thank you for being on the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Kind of starting at the beginning, I'd like to kind of know how you first started to engage with poetry, both as a reader and a writer.
Yeah. So I got into poetry pretty young, actually. I think it had a lot to do with me growing up pretty religious in the Pentecostal church. So I had been read Bible stories and verses and contemplated the Bible pretty early. So it kind of just led me, I think, to see the power of language and the deep emotional power and spiritual power. So I think probably as young as fourth grade, I remember we had a library day where we learned the Dewey Decimal System. And I went into the poetry section and just opened up, I think it was something like Wordsworth, like that I don't read too much anymore. But I remember opening it up and reading it and not being able to understand the words, but just thinking, this is magic. So, yeah. And then I started to write pretty young, too. I started writing in journals. Very, very young, like probably around the same time or before. And probably wrote poems as young as 10. And then, of course, it's developed since then. But yeah, it started pretty early for me.
That's great. What kind of brought you to kind of thinking of, like, when did you start to kind of claim your place as a poet?
Yeah. It's a good question. It's interesting. I was just home in North Dakota visiting my mom, and she recently moved and has piles of my stuff. And so when I was visiting her, she was like, go through this. And there was this big pile of papers from high school even. And I had written a lot of poems and submitted to, you know, various contests when I was probably in high school. I think, you know, that was also a time where I really started to individuate from my religion and become rebellious. And, you know, it's the time where we all figure out who we are. And poetry was a big part of me, I guess, individuating from my family, turning away from my religion, and trying to figure myself out. So I would say, you know, teenage years, and I have journals and journals full of terrible poetry from that time.
So as you were going, starting to grow into being a poet, like, what was the response of the people around you, like from your family and the people that you knew towards
yeah,
that.
It was one of the things that was interesting when I was going through that pile that my mom had given me is that some of, like, when I mentioned I'd submitted to contests, and almost all of them were church-based. So we had this thing called, it was regional teen talent. So I remember I wrote this long rhyming poem about a girl in a small town. It was obviously me, and it was pretty dark and kind of Sylvia Plath inspired. But the last line was like, and then she found Jesus. So I was, you know, very badly trying to kind of, you know, make it fit in for context like that. But honestly, you know, I don't think my mom really read much of it other than the stuff that I submitted, which I doctored up, you know, in that way. But I think, you know, there was no problem with poetry, me being a poet. And I mean, still, I don't think my family really, they buy my stuff and are supportive, and that's nice. But I wonder if they're, I kind of hope they don't read it, actually. Sorry, Mom.
So, how did you come to start pursuing poetry in terms of getting published professionally, and like did you go to school for writing and that sort of thing, or did you kind of forge your own path?
I mean, I started to take poetry more seriously when I was at the New School in New York for my undergrad. Right after I graduated from high school, I moved to Seattle just kind of for no other reason than I wanted to be really far away from home. And I just went to community college. And for those years, I just was trying to, like, you know, figure out how to live on my own without much money. And then I transferred to the New School, and I had a professor, Jennifer Firestone, who really encouraged me. And I think it was through her that I started interning at the, maybe not interning, but I volunteered at the Poetry Project. And then I interned for the poet Brenda Ajima. And when I say interned, I went over to her house and she gave me coffee and tons of books and just talked to me. I didn't do much work. So I started to make those connections. And when I moved to California, I moved to Oakland to go to Mills to get an MFA. But I guess the first thing that I had published was a small chapbook, probably in 2000. Oh, I think it's that, I don't know, 2010, something like that, from Boog City. It's called Walt Disney Light World Extravaganza. Totally different from what I write now. And yeah, I just started to meet people, I guess. I met MG Sparrow, who's one of the Timeless Infinite Light people at Mills. We actually lived together before. We decided to move in together before we really knew each other, but are really good friends now. And my As They Fall book was actually a project that came out of a writing prompt in a workshop at Mills. So yeah, I mean, just kind of naturally through knowing people is how the publications have happened, although it's definitely not always easy. Yeah.
So you also do performance work in addition to your poetry. How has that's informed your poetry writing process, and vice versa, as you've kind of progressed on this path?
Yeah, so I would say that first my poetry kind of informed my performance art. I met Kate Robinson also at Mills. And I think we both were interested in just having, you know, an embodied experience, and had talked about feeling kind of like, I might say it a different way. I guess when I started, I've been writing poems for a long time, or I had been writing poems for a long time before I started doing performance art, where I was basically writing, ideas for performances. And I would think to myself, like, God, wouldn't it be great if I could just do this thing, but for some reason wasn't doing it. And Kate had had similar experiences. And then once we got together, it was like, yeah, let's do this. Let's do this stuff. I think as a writer, I write so much about feeling disembodied or dissociated from myself, because I am. And so a part of, or the big draw for me for doing performance art was just to try to deal with that or highlight that or play with that or just try to figure out more about that. And then after doing the performances, I don't know if it really directly affected my poetry because they're really different modes. The performances that Kate and I had done as the third thing have been, they've had a very loose kind of structure, but it's completely improvised aside from we usually will have made some sort of video that's projecting in the back and, you know, edited it and had that part. But we've used poetry in our performances as well. There's a lot of connections between those.
How did Born Again come into being? Like, what's the path that you took towards pulling that together into a compilation of poetry and essays as well?
When I was at Mills, I was writing a lot of poetry that felt like it wasn't me, actually. Or I think when I was at Mills, I was really just trying to figure out, find my voice. I guess it's a cliche, but that's what I was doing. And even before that, at the New School, I was very kind of language influenced and interested in language poetry. But the move to California, part of the reason that I moved to California was because I was kind of tired of these, or what kind of felt like, at the time, at least the New School specifically, besides my good experience with Jennifer, it had felt very academic and maybe like unwelcoming of something that's more raw and more real and rough around the edges. I went to Mills and, yeah, like I said, didn't really find, didn't write stuff that I was super happy with. And then when I graduated, I basically was just like, okay, I'm going to kill all of the voices in my head telling me what I should write and what I shouldn't. You know, literally like my professor's voices. I'm like, I will kill them. And that's kind of how Born Again started, just trying to come back to the way that I actually wanted to write, but I think I was feeling discouraged and maybe even a little embarrassed that it might have been seen as confessional. I think because, you know, confessionalism is associated with, you know, teenage girls who are melodramatic and, you know, they can't have deep thoughts. I was afraid of that, but I just kind of said, screw it. I'm just going to write whatever I want. And that's how it started.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's a powerful way of claiming your own voice in that way of saying screw it and just going for it. And I think it turned out very well. I really love the book. And it's, as the title suggests, and this is very notable throughout the book, is there's a lot of religious imagery, not just Christian imagery, but also other versions of spirituality. Mm-hmm. And can you maybe speak to a bit about the inspiration for these poems and how you drew these poems together?
Yeah. I mean, I think I started to think a lot about the etymological link between rape and rapture and became really fixated and fascinated with that. Because I did grow up Pentecostal, which for those of you who don't know, it's an ecstatic religion where, you know, people become quote unquote slain in the spirit and they become filled with the Holy Ghost and will do things like speak in tongues or cry uncontrollably or shake or, you know, do a lot of different things. And, you know, my religious upbringing has also been super oppressive. And yeah, so I was thinking about the connections, like I said, between rape and rapture. And also, you know, a lot of it has to do also with my time living in New York and feeling hyper aware of the male gaze. And just also, you know, feeling like there was nowhere that I could go without someone trying to, you know, fuck me either literally or figuratively. So all of those things kind of become entangled. Also, there's a lot in the book about Medea, Pasolini's movie version of Medea in particular. I read a book in college called The Theory of the Novel by Lukács. And basically, he's in the beginning of the book, he's talking about different genres. Like, he's talking about the epic and he's talking about tragedy and he's talking about the novel. And he's looking at these as some sort of indicator of a way to see the historical consciousness of the time, if that makes sense. And so he talks about in the epic where it's a closed world, where I think he says something like the fire of the stars is the self-same fire that burns, you know, in the fire in front of us. And there's no separation between people in some sort of way that's really confounding and hard to understand, but sounds, you know, utopic in a way, or sounded utopic in a way to me when I was reading it pretty young. And so, yeah, I started to think about Medea as this character almost out of Lukács, where she was a figure that had supernatural powers. She was a sorceress within her own land, and then decided to leave it all and kill her brother and steal the golden fleece to follow Jason of the Argonauts, and then starts to basically lose her powers of sorcery. And I actually identified with that a lot growing up Pentecostal and feeling very close to God or a spiritual force, and then becoming utterly bereft of that was really devastating. So, yeah, I mean, Born Again tries to, I guess, tease a lot of these things apart, think through these different subjects that are intertwined.
So the structure of the book has like sections of poems are separated by these really beautiful lyrical essays. And I was wondering how you came to incorporate essays into the collection as a whole and how they're meant to inform the poetry.
Yeah, so I think it took me, you know, a little while, maybe 2 or so years to write Born Again. And as I kept writing it, I became more and more interested in a type of writing that in no way tried to obfuscate what I was saying or doing, or concealing it for maybe avant-garde purposes. Not that the lyric poems do that at all, but I just became more interested in narrative. And I became more interested in writing that had something to actually say, like a direct thing that it was saying. So I think that, the three narratives also, or essays, or I'm not even sure what to call them, they are all, I guess, ecstatic experiences. The first one is, I guess, a sexual experience, where it's written in a way that might lead you to believe that the person writing it is very embodied, or like so embodied it's overwhelming and disembodying at the same time. It's like ecstatic, it's jouissance. And then the second narrative, I think, is the Seattle narrative. I lived in Seattle for a while, and it's about a time. It's about a lot, but there's a narrative kind of woven in there about a time that I, you know, basically smoked weed and had a really intense out of body experience. And then, yeah, there's one that's about a sexual assault in New York, and then the last is about speaking in tongues, probably when I'm about 10 years old, growing up Pentecostal, where I invoke St. Teresa of Avila quite a bit. So it felt important to kind of ground the book in these different experiences, to have different approaches to looking at the ecstatic.
Yeah. As you were talking about, like, the first essay and embodiment, and it's one of the themes that I noticed in the book was this mixture of, like, full embodiment and as well as in addition to this spiritual experience, and how they kind of blend together and kind of connect to each other and have this single experience. Mm-hmm. You've also spoken in other interviews as well as about your own experience in the physicality and that sort of thing. And I was wondering if you would speak a little to that and how that works throughout the book.
Yeah, I mean, I'm writing from my own experience. So, like I said, I have this problem of being dissociated and disembodied a lot of the time. And what I do, is I try to like exercise and like do meditation. And, I'm also a super physical and sensual, person, or like tactile person. Mm-hmm. So I just experience the world, in that way. But at the same time, there's a split where I feel outside of myself so much of the time. So I think that it just comes out of, you know, being in this body and having this experience. But I mean, also, I talked about the male gaze a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. about, you know, kind of dictating my entire experience of living in New York, or what felt like it at least. And so I like to move that I guess, EYE, from internal or physically embodied to external, because it's kind of highlights, I think, the way that you know, women and femmes end up constantly scrutinizing themselves, themselves and trying to see themselves through the eyes of other people, because not because we're shallow, but because society says that our value is laid within our physical appearance. So that's a really big part of it. But also, I think about Foucault's panopticon quite a bit, even just as an image. Like, I remember when I was reading Foucault in, I think at Mills with Diane Katie, she showed us a picture of the panopticon, which is like basically a tower from which the like a jailer observes all of the people being jailed and able to see everything. You know, you don't know if they're ever there or not, but you also, it's like this feeling of being constantly scrutinized and watched, and thinking about how you know, that relates to capitalism, patriarchy, heteronormativity, all of these things, and how that, you know, becomes internalized within us, where you know, that could be a big cause of disembodiment, and feeling like not having an integrated sense of self or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I would love, if there a particular poem that you feel represents the collection well? I would love if you would share one of the poems from the collection with us.
Sure. It's hard. What should I choose? Let's see. I did a reading a while ago, and I still have my little post-it notes. So maybe I'll read. I really like this one. It's called Nothing Tastes Better Than Skinny Feels, which is actually, I struggled with an eating disorder in New York, and my supposed best friend used to tell me that, which I think Kate Moss used to say. And now I'm just like, I just want to tear his head off when I think of him telling me that. But okay, so I'll read this. Nothing tastes better than skinny feels. I'm on top of the world. I grew up a village girl, but now I'm urbane. I used to till the fields. I used to hide my dirty feet from townsfolk. Look at me now. I'm living proof that you can do anything you put your mind to. I used to think I was stuck with this body I was born in. It's this dream I have that I am living, that I am not a ghost. I live in a six-floor walk-up. The view from my bedroom is a brick wall. The view from my living room is a grid of tiny windows. Eyes of the city only reflect. At night, I walk naked to pee under bright lights. Nowhere in the city do I find human touch. The last time I was touched, I was raped. Just kidding. The last time I was touched, I was raped. By day, the women folk whisper and look at me without turning their heads. There's this myth about the human face. I could tell you so many stories. I turn off the lights. The courtyard is locked and filled with garbage. I dream of jumping off. I make a plan. The plan is to fall.
That is such a beautiful piece. And I'm noticing, because I have the book in front of me right now, that it's, I made a little, underlined a couple of things. Mm-hmm. The use of repetition is really lovely. I mean, it works well to provide the emphasis of the thing, like the just kidding, mm-hmm. turn where you take that line, the last time I was touched, I was raped, just kidding, and then repeat, mm-hmm. it's like it creates such a powerful effect.
Thank you. Yeah, it kind of, when you were talking about that, it kind of reminds me of this, it reminds me of Kate and I's performance art a lot, where we did this performance piece in at Alley Cat at this point a couple of years ago for Amy Berkowitz's release party of Tender Points, which is a great TIL book. But it was basically like we were just lamenting women, where we were like, you are going to look at us, you are going to hear us scream. So I mean, we had like these, I guess, these nightgowns on and really like ridiculous gaudy makeup, and so we played this disturbing footage that basically was like a reenactment of, I mean, a reenactment in a loosely based way, actually, of the rape that I'm referring to in this poem. And we just like screamed and tore our nightgowns like to pieces. We had Alka-Seltzer in our mouths and just, you know, through the spit, we were literally foaming at the mouth, for a really, really long time. And it was kind of like, you know, I will make you look at this. You will sit through this.
Yeah. I mean, both the performance you describe and those lines and poetry in general can have this power of making declarations that otherwise people might not listen to, and those lines as well. Yeah. It's like it just reminds me of trying to have a serious conversation about that kind of stuff and it getting too serious for the other person, so you just kidding it, but it's like, no, really. This is a true thing or a real thing, you know? Yeah. So, And, you know, that, yeah, it's a beautiful piece. The jumping off at the end and the Thank falling, you. But it's falling, but it also feels like it's taking flight. Thank so, you. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I like that interpretation.
So one question that came to mind for me that looking at these poems in this book, what would be your hope for what this book would achieve or how it would connect with other readers?
Yeah, I mean, I just hope that, I mean, reading certain poets and certain books as a teenager living in North Dakota, you know, before the age of Amazon, where you could even order anything, where, you know, you really had to search things out or like go to the, you know, whatever little bookstore you had and, you know, order them from them. Books were very precious to me, and got me through very difficult times, or also just it's helped me realize that I wasn't totally crazy or totally weird, because I was really different from, you know, a lot of the people around me. And so I hope somebody could pick this up and maybe this helps them get through, you know, something that they're going through. I just hope it's, you know, I just hope someone picks it up and it speaks to them in some way that helps them parse through some of the difficult questions that, you know, I'm trying to parse through in the book.
I can see that it has the potential to do that, and I certainly hope that it does as well. And so what are you working on now? What can the world expect from you as you continue your path as a poet and performance artist?
Yeah, so I'm actually working on I guess it's a type of memoir. The tentative title is Precious Moments. I actually have a chapbook called Precious Moments, published by Skytrail Press, which is my boyfriend and I. And I haven't really been promoting it too much, but while I'm here, I could say if people do want to get their hands on it, they could just email me at ivy.m.johnson@gmail.com. And then, you know, we'll figure out a Venmo thing. And it's $5. I'll send it to you. It includes shipping for the $5. So What it's about is, you know, actually this time that I keep talking about that I lived in New York and had, you know, just a really hard time and kind of a mental break. I guess a really intense depressive episode that lasted maybe like 2 years. And so it kind of takes off from the more narrative pieces of Born Again. When I was writing those, I was just, you know, really enjoying writing them and getting a lot of good feedback from other people. And so, yeah, I just wanted to write something that was more modeled after those. So there's the chapbook. It'll be a full-length thing. I'm not sure when.
That's awesome. That sounds really, really great. So to kind of close out and wrap up, I would love to know what you're reading right now, or what sort of media that you're consuming right now that you're finding inspiring or loving or just enjoying for the pleasure of it.
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say I've been meaning to read this book for years, and I finally read it. I guess now a little while ago, a month or so ago. But David Wojnarowicz's Close to the Knives, blew my face off or something. It was just, yeah, it was exactly what I needed to read. His writing, it's, yeah, I feel like I can't do it justice with the way that I'm trying to describe it. But I mean, I found it, I kind of read it to start to think about what it's like to write a memoir. And it's so moving and tender and gritty and heartbreaking and real. I just really appreciate writers where it's just kind of no bullshit. It's, you know, they tell it like it is, but in a really beautiful, subtle and nuanced way. So if you haven't read Close to the Knives, I would recommend that.
I haven't, so I'll have to check that out. It sounds wonderful based on your description.
It's great.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate having this conversation with you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. This is New Books and Poetry, a podcast of the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.